we go. That's better. All right. So, where did I put the extras? Oh, goodness. Where did I put the extras? I had extras. Who has them? Oh, here they are. Before we start class, Brother Charles, would you mind leading us in a word of prayer? Thank you, Brother Charles. So, who remembers where we left off last week? Question. Yeah, actually, I think we had... didn't we kind of finish chapter 5?
No, we were close enough.
Okay, yeah. Yeah, we were close enough. Just looking at when the Lamb takes up the scroll, right, basically all of creation sings praises,
yeah.
Right? And there's some comparisons to Philippians 2, for example, that, you know, we've noted in there's, that's quite, you know, compared to number 10, sort of compare this image to Philippians chapter 2, verses 5 through 11. There are some notable images there. By the way, also before we get any further into the lesson, I have for your... I think everybody's got one, right? Chapter 7, questions for chapter 7 and part of chapter 8. I do have all of chapter 8 done, but again, like what happened with chapters 2 and 3, I don't want to waste paper, so I'm waiting until I have an even page to put on the back of the last page for chapter 8. So if anyone hasn't gotten one, they're up here at the front, or if someone walks in, please point them in the direction of here so they can pick one up. But we pretty much finished chapter 5. Madison raised the question of the animals rising up and praising, and we've linked that to Deuteronomy, right? The heavens and the earth, creation itself, singing the praise of God, and standing in witness and judgment on Israel when they violated the covenant, and the various prophets call creation itself to witness. And we also looked at the roles of the wild animals in the judgment for breaking the covenant. Like what happened to those who came in to resettle the northern territory after Assyria wiped out the northern 10 tribes, the forced resettlement there in 1st and 2nd Kings 17. So what we're going to do is we're going to go ahead and get into chapter 6 now. And so chapter 6 gets into sort of the interesting section, right? This is where everything sort of kicks into high gear as far as the visions are concerned. Just in case. But chapter 6 sort of kicks the vision, sort of, it becomes more, let's say, more extreme, right, in sort of the presentation of the vision. So what I want to do is I want to talk a little bit about, I mean, I have some of this in sort of the material for chapter 8. This batteries are dead. Yeah. Someone forgot to turn this one off too. I've got extras. All right, so chapter 6, I mean, in chapters 4 and 5, we have the throne room scene, right? And so, as the scroll is handed to the Lamb, right, remember, what was on the scroll?
Seals.
Seals, right? How many of them?
Seven.
Seven, right? So, what we're going to see from here on out, and I'm just going to give you, I'm going to sort of shortcut to a little bit of what is in chapter 8. What we're going to see is we're going to see the first of sort of three cycles of seven, right? We have seven seals, right? And then we have seven trumpets. And as the seventh trumpet is blown, we see sort of a little interlude, right? There's sort of a break, and then there's another sequence of visions, and then we go back to the three cycles of seven. And so what we have are seven seals, seven trumpets, and seven bowls of wrath that are poured out. And so the seven seals start here in chapter 6. The seven trumpets begin in chapter 7, right? And then the seven bowls of wrath start in chapter 15. But then there's that break from chapter 10 to 14 where there's sort of another scene. There's sort of like a meanwhile, this other stuff is going on, and then we're going to go back to the seven. So I want to just broach the way to look at these three cycles of seven for now. There's sort of like three major ways. One is that a lot of the crowd that ties Revelation to sort of like a direct sequence of events, right? Like this is talking about the end times, quote unquote. Look at each of these three cycles of seven as sort of sequential events, and they're all talking about specific things. And another way to look at it is to look at it sort of in a general sense of that there's sort of the three cycles of seven are sort of talking about the same thing, right? And sort of these two other general ways of looking at it sort of fall in that category. One is that they're sort of parallel, right? So the seven seals, the opening of the seven seals, is really always talking about the same thing as the blowing of the seven trumpets and the pouring out of the seven bowls of wrath. They're all talking about the same thing. Another way is looking at them like little nesting dolls, right? Sort of like a nested sequence, right? That, you know, you have the seven seals, and then as the seventh seal is opened, then the seven trumpets are blown, and as the seventh trumpet is blown, then there's the seven bowls of wrath. And they're all sort of contained within one another. But what that also ultimately means is they're all sort of talking about the same thing, too, right? And so what we find here is a description of what seems to be fairly chaotic and sort of doom and gloom images, right? That there's, you know, there's plague, there's sickness, there's death, there's destruction, there's famine, there's all of these things that go on. But let's remember, it's important to understand the meaning of what? When we look at apocalyptic literature, what do we need to understand the meaning of? Meaning of the symbols as opposed to meaning of the words, right? And, you know, a great primer for understanding this, right, for looking at this, is how Peter interprets Joel chapter 2 and Pentecost, right? There's all these words like the moon is turned to dark, you know, to the skies are turned to darkness and the moon is turned to blood. It seems like that's pretty catastrophic stuff, right? But Peter says, no, that's just what's going on right here now, right? And so it doesn't seem like there's a whole lot of, oh my goodness, end of the world stuff going on at Pentecost. As a matter of fact, it seems rather cool, at least from our perspective. It seems that's a great and amazing day. But yet you find this language used to describe the events that sort of seem like, what in the world is going on? But that's how the Hebrew prophets often worked. And they spoke in this kind of imagery to describe not so much the end of the world in a violent fashion, but the end of an order of things, right? There's a new order of things that is coming, right? And the old order of things is passing away. And that's exactly what happened at Pentecost, right? Because at Pentecost, Jesus was preached, his kingdom was preached, the doors of the kingdom were opened to everybody, and people were added to the assembly of Jesus, the King. And when that happens, what becomes obsolete? for that crowd in particular. Remember, all of those people, what did they all share in common at Pentecost? Yeah, they were all Jews. They were all Jews. The 3,000 plus people that were added to the assembly that day, they were all Jews, right? So for them in that moment, what became invalid? What ceased to matter for them?
The old covenant.
The old covenant, right? The thing that they all had in common now ceased to matter. They were no longer under that. They were now under the new covenant, right? There's a new priesthood. There's a new law. There are new prophets, right? There are new miracle-working prophets. All of that changed. Their entire system, their entire worldview changed in an instant, right? And so that's what this language is describing. Not so much violent cataclysms, right? But the end of an order of things. It's important for us to remember. Now, sometimes the end of that order is violent. For example, the breaking of Egypt in the Exodus, right? That was fairly violent, right? But then you've got Pentecost, the death of the old covenant and the birth of the new, right? Not violent at all, but nevertheless, the same kind of language is used to describe it. So let's remember that as we go into these chapters. And also remember, one of the most important things we can address when we're dealing with this is that I have no other way to relate it that I can use well myself than this one. So I apologize if this is a little whatever. But Revelation is written under two layers of encryption. What I mean by that is, you know, encryption is basically the method by which we make a message secret, right? We use a secret code to sort of hide what's in it, right? And there's a lot of methods that you can use. There's some old school methods like, you know, letter substitution. There's mathematical methods. There's digital methods that you can use just to mess around with the bits these days in an electronic message and in digital information that's being passed. But it's any way of sort of making a message secret, right? And so it's important for us to understand that Revelation is written under two different layers of encryption. Basically, there's two ways that Revelation hides its message, right? Number one, we have the key for this one, is it uses the language of the Old Testament prophets, right? Now that we have that key, so we can unlock that layer of encryption. The other layer is that it's making reference to some things that were fairly obvious to the immediate recipients. Like, they understood some subtle references that John was making here or there, enough that there was absolutely no question what was being referred to for them. Now, we know some of those through our study of history, but we don't know others. So we're never going to perfectly understand Revelation the way the first century target audience did. And you know what? That's okay. Because the first layer of encryption is the most important to decrypt. And since we have the Old Testament prophets, and since we know what these kinds of images mean, we can understand sort of the general thing that John is talking, that Jesus is showing to John, right? That John writes down. So we have sort of a general description of these things. But we don't have a full, exact, comprehensive, 100% understanding, and that's okay. And so because of that, what we're going to have to acknowledge for ourselves as we go throughout this, and that I've been trying to do since we started this, is that none of us is ever going to be able to say with absolute perfect authority, I know exactly what this is talking about. I can tell you, I think I've got a pretty good idea, right? But I'm not going to know 100% exactly what it is. And that only intensifies the further we get into it, right? So I want to just acknowledge that to begin with right now, okay? I'm letting you know. Right, I'm not saying I understand all of it. I'm saying I think I have a decent idea, right? And it's okay for us to have that because, you know, Homer Haley said that we have to present conclusions without dogmatism, but with confidence that our presentation is the most accurate view that fallible human wisdom can determine. And that's actually from his introduction and commentary to Revelation. So we have to maintain this attitude as we wrestle with pictures that are shown to us by John. So keep these things in mind. No person in the vision is identified as a living character aside from Jesus himself, right? There's no specific people that are mentioned in this vision aside from John and Jesus, right? We have symbols, right? But we don't have individual people identified aside from John, our narrator, and Jesus, the focus. No specific historic event is defined in these visions for us, right? No definite point in time is recorded at all for us. We don't even have any fixed points in time that are specified for us objectively and clearly. So what we have to do is we have to use the information we've already learned about symbolism, particularly the importance of facts being emphasized, the facts that are emphasized in the first five chapters. So keep in mind the overall purpose that we've already clearly established is to encourage the faithfulness that will ensure victory, right? And we're talking about victory in the lives of individual people, not victory over some physical earthly enemy. That's not the point, right? Because I achieve victory by remaining faithful unto death. Right? That's how I achieve victory. I achieve victory by dying. So, if in fact this book that is taken from God's hand by the Lamb in chapter 5 has within it the divine purpose of God that's been delegated to the Lamb to carry out, then this is actually of help in understanding what is being revealed as the seals are open. So keep these questions in mind. What's the plan of God? What has happened as the plan of God unfolded doesn't involve Jesus, the gospel, conflict for Christians with the world, and God's judgment, right? So, it's been noted that while the rest of the New Testament imparts truth to the mind, it speaks in plain terms for us, Revelation imparts truth to the eye. It speaks in visions, in fantastic pictures. So we've shown, we'll continue to show as we study the remainder of Revelation, that Christians are being reminded of things that they already know. This isn't new information for us. Just as the Old Testament prophets, by and large, came not to impart new information, but to remind people of their obligations under the law. I mean, there was new information in the form of repent or you'll perish, right? But their obligations under the law were never new. And the prophets simply reminded them of the things that they already knew to be true. And even the or you will perish warning goes back to Deuteronomy, right? If you don't keep this law, what's going to happen? You're going to suffer. And so even the warnings of judgment were a reminder of things that had been previously stated. And so as we read Revelation, it's important to know that it's a reminder to its audience of things that they already knew. So it may be that using these visions will imprint the message or truth even more indelibly in the minds of Christians who are being tested to the ultimate degree. So the revelation of Jesus the King is a reminder that will do the most in sustaining Christians in these most severe circumstances. So that's what's going on in the following, from chapter 6 on out. It's a reminder of the things that they already know, the things that are important. So what we have in chapter 6 is, in verse 1, the Lamb takes the scroll, and what does He do? Breaks the first seal, right? Pops the first seal open. And as He pops the first seal open, what does John hear? He hears thunder, right? He said he one of the four living creatures with a voice like thunder. And that voice from one of the four living creatures, remember these are the four living creatures that surround the throne, right? That voice tells John what? Come. Take a look. So he looks and he sees what? A white horse. All right. So the white horse, its rider had a bow and a crown was given to him and he came out conquering and to conquer. Right? So who's the rider on the white horse? This is a good question, by the way. I think it's a good question. Anyone? Yeah. I mean, look at the identifiers, right? Look at the description of the rider on the white horse, right? He's got, first of all, he's white. He's described as white, right? So what does white symbolize? Purity, holiness, right? How many entities are intrinsically holy by their very nature? Well, there's one, and that's God, right? Jesus being God qualifies, right? There's one entity that is intrinsically, axiomatically holy by his very nature, and that's God. So you've got white, right? You've got a bow. What is a bow? It's a weapon of war, right? It's a weapon of war. It's a powerful weapon of war because ranged weapons in the days of hand-to-hand combat are force multipliers. Just ask the French who survived no French survived Agincourt. That's right. Sorry, this is my little history joke for you. So you've got this powerful weapon of war. And then he's also wearing what? A crown. And he conquers, right? So who's described as having conquered already? The Lamb, right? The Lamb who was slain has conquered, right? And that's chapter 5. That's the opening of chapter 5. So here in the opening of chapter 6, you see Jesus riding forth to conquer. By the way, what does that remind you guys of? Does that remind you guys of anything in the Old Testament? Yeah, chapter 19, right? Jesus riding forth on a white horse with white garments, but his linen robes are stained with blood, which sort of evokes the Day of Atonement, right? Yeah. Yeah, there's this image of perfection and victory associated with it, right? So, Jesus riding forth to conquer, to go to war, to go to battle, does that remind you of anything in the Old Testament? It reminds me of a few things. Zechariah. Right. Zechariah chapter 1, that's a good one. Anywhere else? Isaiah 59. Do we remember Isaiah 59? The people are grasping for righteousness. They're grasping for justice. But there's none to be found. And God sees it and it displeases him that there's no one that can bring justice or righteousness to the people. And so in chapter 59 of Isaiah, in the middle of verse 15, the Lord saw it, and it displeased him that there was no justice. He saw that there was no man, and he wondered that there was no one to intercede. And then his own arm brought him salvation, and his righteousness upheld him. He put on righteousness as a breastplate and a helmet of salvation on his head. He put on garments of vengeance for clothing and wrapped himself in zeal as a cloak. And so according to their deeds, so he will repay wrath to his adversaries, repayment to his enemies. To the coastlands he will render repayment. And so they shall fear the name of the Lord from the west and his glory from the rising sun. For he shall come like a rushing stream which the wind of the Lord drives. And a redeemer will come to Zion and to those in Jacob who turn from transgression. Right? God comes down to earth to conquer sin and death. That's a picture of the crucifixion, isn't it? So we have all kinds of... You've got Zechariah 1, we've got Isaiah 59. We've got the Messianic Psalms, don't we? And we've got Joshua as an archetype as well, right? Joshua is an archetype. He's one of those, shadow substance characters. You got David, too. I mean, pick a character, the judges, right? You got this whole cycle of people who can't break the oppression of the enemy until the king comes along, right? There you go, right? The whole cycle from the judges to the United Kingdom is another image of Jesus coming down to conquer sin and death after our failed attempts to deal with it ourselves. So we have here the first rider. Yeah?
I have Revelation chapter 19, verses 11 through 16, which says, I saw heaven standing open, and there before me was a white horse, whose rider is called Faithful and True.
Right.
With justice, he was with justice and wage and rule, his eyes were like blazing fire. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. That's what Elmore was referring to earlier. Those texts, that those verses that you just read, is what Elmore was referring to earlier, right? And that's spot on. So, you know, here two different times, and you know, at least in Revelation 19, it's obvious who that's referring to, because you know, you look at, you know, John calls him the Word of God. Go back to John chapter 1, right? And it's obvious who John is describing from looking at John's other writings. So here we find all the similar imagery and the similar description here of the conquering king wearing a crown coming to conquer in chapter 6. And it's really easy for us to make the connection internally, but also externally as well. This ties in with a lot of images of Jesus in the Old Testament as the conquering king. So there we go. So the first breaking of the seal is Jesus himself coming forth, right? So we have this, what we have is, you know, the breaking of the seal sort of starts a new sequence of images, right? That's sort of contained within the throne room scene of the Lamb. It's like John is watching this throne room scene, right? And then the, you know, if we're depicting it like in cinematic fashion, right? The first seal breaks open and then flash to white, and then John sees this new thing. And all of that is happening in the throne room scene. John is seeing all of this play out while he's in the throne room scene. It's sort of like a vision within a vision. So. Yeah. We're going to get into the riders that come forth in each seal, right? So, the first rider, the white horse, right? So the second rider, which was what we were just about to get into, as he opens the second seal, who speaks now? The second living creature, right? And how many living creatures are there? Four. So first seal, one. Second seal, number two. And what does this creature say? Come. Same thing. Come and see. Right? And so, out comes what? Another horse. But how is this horse described? Bright red. Right? Its rider is permitted to take what? Peace from the earth. Right? And so that people should slay one another, and he was given a great sword. So what's this talking about? What does that mean? Okay, let's just go with the color, right? Bright red.
War.
Blood. Death. Right? Blood. War. Right? So what do you think this means? Remember, seals, breaking seals, dispensing knowledge, human history and God's plan.
I think it's the war against sin and death. And Christ is already claiming
victory. Right. It could be the war against sin and death, right? And that's a pretty potent image, right? We could also be talking about the fact that, you know, we look at blood and life and the spilling of life, right? One of the things that we could be looking at here, there's a lot of potential things, is, you know, the war over sin and death can be symbolized by the repeated sacrifices that were offered at the temple. Because those sacrifices serve as a testament to man's failure over sin. Because you keep having to need new sacrifices and new sacrifices and new sacrifices and new sacrifices. And so if we're going with the angle of this represents the war against sin and death, then I there's no problem with me connecting those images together, right? Because, you know, we're continually struggling against this, right? Any other potential takes on this?
But you could also, like the emperors that are conquering,
just war in general, human war, right? So that's another possible take on this, right? That throughout human history, mankind has waged war against one another, often with ill intent and to ill end. And it shows sort of, most wars in human history, most of them, are fought because someone gets an ego that's a little too big. When you boil it right down to the bare essentials, mostly it's about someone who's gotten an ego that's become a little too big, and they decide and they think that it's okay for them to enforce their ego on others. And then you get war. You get the people who assassinated Archduke Ferdinand, kicking off World War I. And they're the real culprits, right? You know, today we would call them terrorists, wouldn't we? You've got Adolf Hitler. You've got Pol Pot. You pick a war, right? You've got someone who's responsible for starting it, and mostly what it boils down, almost all the time, what it boils down to is ego. So it's possible that we're just talking about the fact that human beings have fought war as a result of their enslavement to sin, right? That our pride and our ego lead to this competition, right? This loss of life that occurs. Right, the removal of peace, right? And as long as we are enslaved by sin, right? As long as we're under them. By the way, there's nothing that says it can't be both of these at the same time, right? There's nothing that says that at all. That as long as we are enslaved by sin, right? Ego is going to be a problem, isn't it? And as long as people are given to a lifestyle that is contrary to the Word of God, there's always going to be someone who comes along who starts something, right? And that's just inevitable. Looking at human history, it's just the way it is, right? When it talks about, when Isaiah talks about people beating their swords into plowshares, right? That only really happens if you submit to God's law, to God's word, to the way of the Messiah, doesn't it? Right? If you don't do that, then you know you're still a large predatory mammal living by your large predatory mammal instincts. You're still following the wisdom from below as opposed to the wisdom from above. And this conflict is the inevitable result of that, right? So there's nothing that says it can't be both at the same time. So third seal, right? Third seal is open, verse 5. As the Lamb opens the third seal, we see this other flash, right? And here's the third living creature, and the third living creature says, come, like the first two, right? So he looks, and now what does he see? A black horse, right? Right. And this black horse represents, he's got a pair of scales in his hand. Here we seem to a voice from the midst of the four living creatures saying, a quart of wheat for a denarius and three quarts of barley for a denarius, and do not harm the oil and the wine. By the way, the prices here are about 8 to 10 times the normal prices for the measure of food that is being discussed. This is massive inflation, and this happens in a famine, right? So why does famine occur? What are the reasons that famine occurs? What's that? Well, I mean, people are starving, right? But why do famines occur? Okay, there's a drought, right? I mean, famine's a lack of food. That's the definition. But why does a lack of food occur? VR gave us drought. Right? Are there any other reasons why famine occurs? Climate change? I'm not going to disagree with that.
It could also be man-made on a second.
Man-made?
Ben had it when he visited Samaria.
Right. So, I mean, man-made climate change. Or it could be the result of the destruction of crops. Right? The active destruction of crops. Asset denial, they call that in military terminology, right? That can result in famine too, right? Asset denial. But, you know, we're talking about, you know, like people burning the crops of their enemies, right? And that inflates prices. Or just the simple attrition, the simple collateral damage to farms that happens. You know, armies don't like to march over mountains. Surprise, right? They like to march over nice, wide, flat pieces of land, right? That's what they like to march over. That's the best way to get troops to the enemy, is to find a nice, wide, flat, large piece of land and just drive the army right through it. Yeah, most wide, flat pieces of land, you know what they're called? Farms, right? They're called farms. You just ask Belgium what happens when Germany wants to invade somebody, right? Belgium was barely getting off of its feet after World War I when Hitler decides to invade France. Now, you can either go over the Alps or you can go through Belgium. Once again, Belgium got flattened to the ground and everybody starved. Just ask the Belgians what happens when armies march through your territory. So they have a great deal of authority on the subject. So we're talking, I mean, there's a lot of these things that are connected, but ultimately, you know, if we're dealing with drought or climate change, right? Or even, you know, what happens with human causes other than climate, just active, direct human causes. What's that?
An act of God.
An act of God, right? A judgment, divine judgment.
Yeah.
Right, Joseph in Genesis, or the 3.5 years of famine during the days of Elijah, right? The 3.5 years of drought that resulted in famine there. So whichever one we have, right, whichever one is the cause, let's just roll with natural causes for now. Are natural causes natural? This is a good question. I want us to actually think about it. Are natural causes actually natural? Demetrius, Darius, any of you guys want to go out on a limb? Are natural causes actually natural or not?
You can look at it two ways.
Okay, you can look at it two ways. I really only look at it one way.
But at the same time, it gives a setback sometimes. Let things happen.
Right, and let's just exclude for the moment things that are God's providence, God's work. Okay, let's exclude those things. Let's go with things that are actually natural. Are they natural? I'm going to posit that I don't think any natural cause is natural. They're all man-made. Exactly. But there are, the ones that aren't from God are all from man. Genesis chapter 3. Cursed is the ground because of you. Cursed is the ground because of you. The world broke that day. How God designed things to happen was forever changed and altered that day. All of these natural causes can be laid at the feet of Adam and Eve, and you know, the first humans breaking God's commandment in the Garden of Eden. Creation was forever changed that day. And it was changed to the ill consequence that humanity has to endure because of it. Yeah, consequence. It's a consequence. You know, all of the things that are natural causes go back to that because the world is broken. All natural things are a product of human sin, either directly or our own or Adam and Eve.
Yeah.
Right, that the guilt of sin can be taken away. Yeah, Elm was referencing for the record, Genesis chapter 3, verses 15 and 16, that the spiritual consequences of sin are taken away, even though some of the physical consequences remain. If you do something that is ill-advised with somebody in a rather intimately physical fashion, and you end up contracting a disease because of that, can you be forgiven? Absolutely. Does that mean you're going to get rid of the disease? Not necessarily. Depends on whether or not antibiotics will fix it or whether or not we have some other treatment for it, right? Some things you will never get rid of as far as the technology that's available to us at the present day. But that doesn't mean the guilt will remain on your soul. And that's the way it is with the brokenness of creation, right? The guilt of sin is taken away. We don't inherit the guilt of Adam and Eve's sin. But the physical consequences of their sin remains for the rest of the duration of creation. So even the natural disasters are a result of human sin. Not ours, theirs. So, famine, fourth seal. The fourth creature speaks to John, says, "Come." So he goes to the fourth creature, and they see what?
A pale horse.
A pale horse, right? Sort of like a... Yeah, the word that's used to describe this is sort of like a sallow greenish kind of grayish line color. It's that color of, like, ew, nasty zombie color, actually. It's this sort of really sickly grayish green color. It's death. Hades follows after him. And they were given authority over a fourth of the earth to kill with the sword, with famine and pestilence, by wild beasts of the earth. So, when we get to this, right, we see this image of creation suffering, right? And that is indeed the picture that's painted by the biblical narrative. Creation suffers. Now, Jesus comes to end the suffering, right? To end the spiritual consequences of all of these things. But the physical things themselves endure, and they will as long as creation endures and sin exists. But there's a consequence to that. Because anytime you have people trying to be righteous and people who are opposed to righteousness, what do you have? What do you get? And this is sort of the evolution, right? Of, you know, we get from what's described in verses 6, it fits with verse 5, right? And you have the rider and the pale horse in verses 7 and 8. His purpose is to bring death, right? Question number 7, we look at verse 9, right? Let's look at the fifth seal real quick. When he opened the fifth seal, I saw under the altar the souls of those who had been slain for the word of God and the witness they had borne. Do you guys think that might be a connection, a natural evolution of the things that have been described in the previous writers? Yeah, but I do. Because any time you have people who are trying to live righteously and you have people who are opposed to righteousness, what happens? You got conflict, right? That's the very state that the recipients of this letter are in. They're in a state of conflict, right? They're being persecuted by the imperial cult of the Roman Empire. So you've got conflict. And when that happens, when you have conflict, and when you have this violent conflict that they were under, what is the result of that? Death. And who dies, typically? The righteous end up dying more often than not. The righteous end up becoming the most common victim. Hebrews chapter 11, right? Men of whom the world was not worthy. Yeah. So, what we have is we have in the fifth seal the consequence of the others that preceded it. That as long as sin reigns on the earth, there will be the death of the righteous as martyrs. And that's just going to be the way things work. And so these martyrs, in their martyrdom, they ask God a question. What do they ask? Right? How long before you're going to judge and avenge our blood? How long will you allow this murder to continue? I mean, that reminds us of Habakkuk, doesn't it? Doesn't it? Reminds me of Habakkuk, right? I mean, that's the question Habakkuk asked God. And God's response in Habakkuk was what? What does Habakkuk 2:20 say? The Lord is in his holy temple. Let all the earth keep silent before him. The answer that God gave to Habakkuk is, you don't need to know. You don't need to know. You just don't need to know. Trust God. That's what you need to do. Trust God. And so when they ask this question, did they even get an answer?
They do.
They do, right? But they're given white robes and rest a little longer until the number of their fellow servants and their brothers should be complete, who were to be killed as they themselves had been. God's answer to the martyrs who had been slain is more people have to die. How's that for an answer? It's not the one we want, is it? It's not the one they're looking for. It's not the one we want either, is it? But that's the only answer God gives. You know what this actually reminds me of? It reminds me of the language that God used to describe the Canaanites. When God promised Canaan to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, right? That he said to them that the sin of the iniquity of the Amorite was not yet full. Right? But in the days of Moses and Joshua, he said the iniquity of the Amorites is full. And when we went through that in the Old Testament on Sunday mornings, right? I said that, you know, picture it like there's this bull, right? And let's just go with the bull image. And when this and this bull is a measurement of God's tolerance for someone's sin or a group of people, the sin of a group of people, right? And so when that bowl gets full, right? When God's tolerance for this person's sin has reached its limit, he pours it out in fire and blood and death. Consequences, right? The seven bowls of wrath. Wonder why I used the bowl image. There you go. But, I mean, that's the picture, right? And we often do this ourselves as parents, right? How many of us have either said or have heard it said to us by our parents, I have had it up to here with whatever it is, right? I heard it. I heard it, right? I heard it growing up. But that's what we're talking about, right? We're talking about the limit of God's tolerance for this sin reaching its maximum. So that's where we're going to leave off tonight. We'll pick up with question 9 and 10 following there right next week, and we'll deal with starting in chapter 6 verse 9, 10, 11, and 12, right? We'll go on from there. So thank you everybody for being here, for your presence, and our class tonight is officially dismissed.